Državni ispitni center.
Maturità generale 2016.
Prova d'ascolto.
A tutti voi un cordiale saluto. Siamo all'inizio della prova d'ascolto d'inglese.
Questa prova d'esame si compone di due parti, la parte A e la parte B. Per ciascuna parte ascolterete un testo e risponderete poi a un esercizio che a esso si ricollega. Dapprima leggerete l'esercizio, poi ascolterete ciascun testo per due volte e risolverete l'esercizio durante l'ascolto. L'inizio e la fine del testo saranno indicati dal seguente segnale acustico.
Scrivete le vostre risposte negli spazi appositamente previsti all'interno della prova, utilizzando la penna stilografica o la penna a sfera. Scrivete in modo leggibile e ortograficamente corretto. In caso di errore, tracciate un segno sulla risposta scorretta e scrivete accanto ad essa quella corretta. Alle risposte e alle correzioni scritte in modo illeggibile verranno assegnati 0 punti.
Abbiate fiducia in voi stessi e nelle vostre capacità. Vi auguriamo buon lavoro.
Ascoltate con attenzione. Aprite la prova d'esame.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Dr. William Fisher, the medical professional who has witnessed Ebola suffering. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Another medical professional who's witnessed Ebola suffering firsthand is Dr. William Fisher of Chapel Hill in North Carolina. You may remember Dr. Fisher from a previous edition of Boston Calling a little while back. He was treating Ebola patients in the town of Gekadu in Guinea. He's been telling me more about what healthcare workers heading to affected areas can expect to face.
The true tragedy lies not necessarily in who is infected, but just that somebody is infected with a virus that by all accounts is preventable. The working conditions are difficult, and they're difficult for a number of reasons. There's an incredible emotional fatigue. For one, the mortality rate's devastating. On a good week, your mortality rate of 60% still means that 6 out of 10 people die. That's incredibly emotionally fatiguing. There's also a physical fatigue factor that some people have discussed, and it stems from the necessity to wear incredibly protective equipment. You're essentially, there's not a single inch of skin that's exposed. And these suits can get incredibly hot. And I actually took a thermometer in with me one day and registered 40 degrees Celsius, which is around 115, 116 degrees Fahrenheit inside the suit. And so you lose between 3 to 5 liters of sweat every time that you go into this treatment facility, and on average you go in 2 or 3 times a day. And in this setting, when you're trying to take care of patients and trying to place IVs, you're sweating profusely, and that sweat is pouring into your eyes, impairing your ability to see. Your goggles are fogging up. So there's an incredible opportunity to become infected throughout your day.
On top of all that, there have been reports that a number of villages in Guinea have become wary of foreign doctors and NGOs coming into their villages. Are you hearing those stories?
Absolutely. I think this is a major impediment to ending this outbreak. From the beginning, there was incredible mistrust. And to be honest, I can't blame the mistrust because these treatment facilities are doing all the right things to try to help patients out. But the reality is that upwards of 9 out of 10 patients who present to these treatment facilities come home in a body bag. So I can understand the incredible mistrust that exists between the affected communities and the healthcare providers.
I know you've been speaking with some of your colleagues who are in the field right now. What kind of things are they telling you? Like, what are villagers cautious and wary of?
I've received reports of two colleagues who went out into the field to try to locate a woman who was displaying symptoms of Ebola. And within a matter of moments, they quickly became surrounded by a growing crowd of young men who started yelling things at them and apparently one even brandished a machete, which prompted them to obviously get in the car and to leave out of fear for their own safety, unfortunately without the young woman who may have or may not have been infected.
When you were there, were you afraid of becoming affected?
I would love to tell you that I was stoic and had no fear at all, but the fear was almost paralyzing. I would say the most difficult time for me was the 5 days before I left, and it was that time where I was thinking, you know, I was reflecting upon what I knew about Ebola, and unfortunately a lot of that came from popular media, which portrays infected patients as patients who are bleeding out uncontrollably with a near uniformly fatal disease. And so that was incredibly difficult to convince my wife and my two young boys that that this was the right thing to do. I think we all knew it was the right thing to do, but it was paralyzing. The fear was absolutely paralyzing.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Another medical professional who's witnessed Ebola suffering firsthand is Dr. William Fisher of Chapel Hill in North Carolina. You may remember Dr. Fisher from a previous edition of Boston Calling a little while back. He was treating Ebola patients in the town of Gekadu in Guinea. He's been telling me more about what healthcare workers heading to affected areas can expect to face.
The true tragedy lies not necessarily in who is infected, but just that somebody is infected with a virus that, by all accounts, is preventable. The working conditions are difficult, and they're difficult for a number of reasons. There's an incredible emotional fatigue. For one, the mortality rate's devastating. On a good week, your mortality rate of 60% still means that 6 out of 10 people die. That's incredibly emotionally fatiguing. There's also a physical fatigue factor that some people have discussed, and it stems from the necessity to wear incredibly protective equipment. You're essentially – there's not a single inch of skin that's exposed, and these suits can get incredibly hot. And I actually took a thermometer in with me one day and registered 40 degrees Celsius, which is around 115, 116 degrees
Wow.
Fahrenheit inside the suit. And so you lose between 3 to 5 liters of sweat every time that you go into this treatment facility, and on average you go in 2 or 3 times a day. And in this setting, when you're trying to take care of patients and trying to place IVs, you're sweating profusely, and that sweat is pouring into your eyes, impairing your ability to see. Your goggles are fogging up. So there's an incredible opportunity to become infected throughout your day.
On top of all that, there have been reports that a number of villages in Guinea have become wary of foreign doctors and NGOs coming into their villages. Are you hearing those stories?
Absolutely. I think this is a major impediment to ending this outbreak. From the beginning, there was incredible mistrust. And to be honest, I can't blame the mistrust, because these treatment facilities are doing all the right things to try to help patients out. But the reality is that upwards of 9 out of 10 patients who present to these treatment facilities come home in a body bag. So I can understand the incredible mistrust that exists between the affected communities and the healthcare providers.
I know you've been speaking with some of your colleagues who are in the field right now. What kind of things are they telling you? Like, what are villagers cautious and wary of?
I've received reports of two colleagues who went out into the field to try to locate a woman who was displaying symptoms of Ebola. And within a matter of moments, they quickly became surrounded by a growing crowd of young men who started yelling things at them. And apparently one even brandished a machete, which prompted them to obviously get in the car and to leave out of fear for their own safety, unfortunately without the young woman who may have or may not have been infected.
When you were there, were you afraid of becoming affected?
I would love to tell you that I was stoic and had no fear at all, but the fear was almost paralyzing. I would say the most difficult time for me was the 5 days before I left, and it was that time where I was thinking, you know, I was reflecting upon what I knew about Ebola. And unfortunately, a lot of that came from popular media, which portrays infected patients as patients who are bleeding out uncontrollably with a near uniformly fatal disease. And so that was incredibly difficult to convince my wife and my two young boys that that this was the right thing to do. I think we all knew it was the right thing to do, but it was paralyzing. The fear was absolutely paralyzing.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Tanya Bunsell, the bodybuilder. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Now, some people think that images of female bodybuilders with their broad shoulders and tiny waists, bulging biceps and thighs, often displayed in miniature bikinis, are quite grotesque. But others see the activity as a way of women taking control of their own body image. It's a world that has fascinated the British sociologist Tanya Bunsell since she was a child. So when she decided to carry out academic research into the activity, she started to train as a bodybuilder herself. She told me about her routine.
It was quite an obsessive one. I certainly got up at 5 o'clock in the morning because that's when my group of female bodybuilders trained. I had a very regimented diet. I would eat every couple of hours things like sweet potato or rice for your main meals.
What about the physical training? How much of that did you have to do every day?
I did a couple of hours of training every day, which was quite intense.
Because you got quite drawn into the idea of building your muscles, presumably.
Yes.
You got quite addicted to it, might I say?
Yes, of course. Yes, I think I look back at certainly my diary notes, which are frustrated with not being able to get my legs up to the size that I wanted to, and the exasperation and irritation and annoyance that I felt when I didn't embody this ideal image. And certainly I was thinking about it all the time. I was hanging around with the female bodybuilders in the evenings.
How big did you get?
I didn't get that big. As you can see, I'm very slight, but I did put on 2 stone compared to what I am now of muscle. And
2 stone of extra muscle?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. And where did that come? On your biceps, on your arms, and on your thighs?
My arms were a couple of inches bigger. My legs, which are very slim, 3 inches. So my arms were about 14 inches, which is probably and defined. So they were probably bigger than the average guy's arm. So they were enough to make a statement to people outside of the subculture that, yes, she did some kind of training.
What did you learn about the psychology of the women who were in the sport or the pursuit all the time? Why had they started, many of them, to get involved in this?
There were actually quite diverse reasons. Sometimes it was just they'd had an injury and it was about rehab, or they found they were actually good at it. A lot of them appreciated the look. They found that very attractive. They wanted to embody those particular traits. Muscles are usually associated with men and masculinity and power and control, and they wanted to embody them themselves but still be seen as very feminine. For others, there were specific events which triggered why they wanted to become a female bodybuilder.
What sort of things?
Some had problems with alcohol. Others, they just had a child and wanted to reclaim their body, or they'd been in an abusive relationship. So it did vary. Some were extreme events that had happened in people's lives, and others it was just a trickle into this particular lifestyle.
Is there an element of what I've heard called body dysmorphia, the sense that some people suffer from a disease or an illness which means that they're not satisfied with their appearance and they can get quite depressed about their appearance?
Yes, absolutely. I do think there is body dysmorphia, or bigorexia as they commonly like to call it, and that's something associated with men as not being seen as big enough, and they go to the gym to try and get bigger. And I think with these women, there is that as well, that their bodies are never good enough. So sometimes they can have pleasure, especially when they're dieting down to competition and they become very hard and vascular. And
now you will hear the recording again.
Now, some people think that images of female bodybuilders with their broad shoulders and tiny waists, bulging biceps and thighs, often displayed in miniature bikinis, are quite grotesque. But others see the activity as a way of women taking control of their own body image. It's a world that has fascinated the British sociologist Tanya Bunsell since she was a child. So when she decided to carry out academic research into the activity, she started to train as a bodybuilder herself. She told me about her routine.
It was quite an obsessive one. I certainly got up at 5 o'clock in the morning because that's when my group of female bodybuilders trained. I had a very regimented diet. I would eat every couple of hours things like sweet potato or rice for your main meals.
What about the physical training? How much of that did you have to do every day?
I did a couple of hours of training every day, which was quite intense.
Because you got quite drawn into the idea of building your muscles, presumably.
Yes.
You got quite addicted to it, might I say?
Yes, of course. Yes, I think I look back at certainly my diary notes, which are frustrated with not being able to get my legs up to the size that I wanted to, and the exasperation and irritation and annoyance that I felt when I didn't embody this ideal image. And certainly I was thinking about it all the time. I was hanging around with the female bodybuilders in the evenings.
How big did you get?
I didn't get that big. As you can see, I'm very slight, but I did put on 2 stone compared to what I am now of muscle and water.
2 stone of extra muscle?
Yes.
Wow. And where did that come? On your biceps, on your arms and on your thighs?
My arms were a couple of inches bigger. My legs, which are very slim, 3 inches. So my arms were about 14 inches, which is probably and defined. So they were probably bigger than the average guy's arm. So they were enough to make a statement to people outside of the subculture that, yes, she did some kind of training.
What did you learn about the psychology of the women who were in the sport or the pursuit all the time? Why had they started, many of them, to get involved in this?
There were actually quite diverse reasons. Sometimes it was just they'd had an injury and it was about rehab, or they found they were actually good at it. A lot of them appreciated the look. They found that very attractive. They wanted to embody those particular traits. Muscles are usually associated with men and masculinity and power and control, and they wanted to embody them themselves but still be seen as very feminine. For others, there were specific events which triggered why they wanted to become a female bodybuilder.
What sort of things?
Some had problems with alcohol. Others, they just had a child and wanted to reclaim their body, or they'd been in an abusive relationship. So it did vary. Some were extreme events that had happened in people's lives, and others it was just a trickle into this particular lifestyle.
Is there an element of what I've heard called body dysmorphia, the sense that some people suffer from a disease or an illness which means that they're not satisfied with their appearance and they can get quite depressed about their appearance?
Yes, absolutely. I do think there is body dysmorphia, or bigorexia as they commonly like to call it, and that's something associated with men as not being seen as big enough, and they go to the gym to try and get bigger. And I think with these women, there is that as well, that their bodies are never good enough. So sometimes they can have pleasure, especially when they're dieting down to competition and they become very hard and vascular. And
this is the end of section B.
Siamo alla conclusione della prova d'ascolto d'inglese. Smettete di scrivere, chiudete la prova d'esame e posatela sull'orlo del banco insieme alla scheda di valutazione.
Ancora un cordiale saluto.